Thank you. Good morning, community. Good to see so many of you here. Hey, I want to chat a little this morning about why it's such a beautiful thing for me to be here today and for me to see you here today and connect us back a little bit to our faith tradition and what, at least in part, brings us here together. A faith tradition that goes back 2,000 years. Probably the most wonderful season of my life, which is ongoing, that I entered into was the study of church history and really beginning to understand the evolution of our faith and our faith tradition and its theology. So I fell in love with that. What I found out is that, you know, and when I started that study, it really, in one sense, it's without end. But when I started that study, I realized how much, A, I didn't know, B, how much, in general, the church doesn't know. Mostly when you go to church, if you've gone to Bible studies, and you just, you know, you regurgitate the same stuff over again. And very, very few people delve into the complexities of how we get what we got, whether it's the Bible or whether it's the way we're doing church or how that evolved. So today, I just want to take a little bit and talk a little bit about our history. And when we talk about, you know, I love world religions. I love to study history in particular. And it's interesting to see how certain religious traditions evolved. Certainly in our faith tradition, we ride on the coattails of an earlier faith tradition of Judaism, from which Christianity has branched off of or engrafted into, depending on who you talk to. And then you get Islam, another dominant world religion. These three gigantic religions of that dominate much of the world, particularly Christianity and the Western world, have all similar parentage and connection and root. And it's really notable to understand some of this because it applies hugely to where we are today. I remember once I was having dinner with an archaeologist from Israel, and we were in Jerusalem, as a matter of fact. This man was an amazing guy. He was like a triple PhD. And, you know, his fascination with Christianity in particular as a non-practicing Jew and archaeologist and historian is just to trace how things expand. You know, I love, you know, I remember World War II history was fascinating to me. I studied that for a period of time, and you look at World War II history with the hindsight of 2020 vision, and you just are amazed at how many nuances, how many things could have ended up differently had this thing, you know, had the weather been different, had this battle been lost, had this message not been intercepted, like monumental shifts in the battle were taking place. And in history, you find that often too. You know, whatever history you look at, history of nations, countries, cultures, often there are certain things that you go like, wow, if that hadn't happened, who knows where we'd be today or where we would have gone. And in Christianity, it's as well. And this archaeologist is just fascinated because, as he would say to me, he goes, it shouldn't have made it. It really, as a fledgling new religions and as a religious expert, he's saying that, you know, the odds were infinitesimal that Christianity would have made it out of Jerusalem as a small sliver sect of Judaism that was already under intense scrutiny and persecution. But events of history saw it limp along and then become this world religion and this, you know, many would argue the biggest, longest 2,000-year tradition of religions. I want to talk about one aspect that scholars are talking about today of one of the things that caused our faith to make it. And it was still very early in the infancy of Christianity. as a world religion. The world was Greco-Roman. It was ruled by the Roman Empire and ruled by their emperors. And Christianity was growing like a weed out of the cracks of this system. We're talking middle of the second century. So about 100 years is a phase that I want to look at under an emperor, Marcus Aurelius, and his co-emperor at the time, who was Lucius Verus. And they were co-emperors of the Roman Empire. And the year is about 166 A.D. 166 A.D., Christianity is still in its infancy. There is no Bible, okay, the way we're so used to clutching a Bible and reading the Bible. There was no Bible then. The Christian movement had shifted from a small, narrow Jewish sect that was persecuted within Judaism and seen as a cult within Judaism, went to the Gentile world, Gentile being anybody that's not a Jew, and as the Apostle Paul spread this throughout the Roman Empire, we often think of it as being much bigger than it actually was. It was these tiny seeds that were spread out in the empire of this fledgling faith that at this time was simply called the Way. As I said, there was no Bible. There was letters, there were parchments, there were pieces. The Gospels at 166 A.D. Were barely circulating still. And so people had parts and pieces and letters and of Paul, and there was a lot of different versions of Christianity that existed in 166 A.D. But there was still the core, which is the center of our faith, which is Jesus and seminal Jesus teachings that had taken root. In 166, Lucius Verus took his Roman legions to defend the east against the Parthian invasion. And as they went to the east, they encountered the Parthians and roundly and soundly defeated them. When they came back from the east, however, those legions carried with them a plague unseen before in the Western world. This was called the smallpox. Smallpox is something we're not very familiar with. Because of vaccinations, it's been virtually eradicated from the face of the earth. But in its day, it was the fiercest of plagues that you can imagine. It was gruesome. It was incredibly contagious and incredibly high mortality rate. It was a very fatal disease, and it ravaged the bodies. The bodies of the survivors of the disease were often mutilated beyond recognition, as the body would be covered with literally countless thousands of boils that would burst and scar, and they would literally be covered in scar tissue from head to toe. Fingers, appendages, nose, ears, feet would fall off during the disease. And if you survived it, many people thought it was worse than had you died in it. It was a horrible plague. They brought this back, and because the legions separated to different parts of the Roman world, it hit the entire Roman world, who were all virgins to this disease. They had no immunities, had not experienced this disease. It killed, in fact, Verus, and eventually it killed Aurelius as well. And it devastated the empire. In fact, it was about a 23-year span from 166 that this disease continued to spread and ravage until it finally ran out of steam. In some places, some of the cities, two-thirds of the occupants died. They estimate the overall mortality rate to be about 15%. There was actually two strains of the disease that they brought back. One was 100% fatal. You literally hemorrhaged and bled out. And the other was about 30% fatal. And overall, there was about a 15%, in some areas 30% rate of death. So you have to think about like living in your neighborhood and say you've got 30 people on your street, and 9 of them die on your street out of 30. And then you got to think that's the next street over, and the next, 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 and that's your whole community being devastated. Those are the ones that died. Then you have those that survived, who were horribly disfigured and crippled by the disease. This is absolute devastation. What we see, interestingly enough, because this is a very well-documented part of history, especially with Roman history. For instance, there was a famous doctor by the name of Galen, G-A-L-E-N, who wrote prolifically on what he was encountering with this particular disease. And basically, two things happened in Rome we see sociologically. Number one, there were two responses to the disease, which was either fear or flight. That was it. Fear and flight. People were terrified, horrified, and if they didn't have the disease, they were fleeing everyone that did have it, or any community or town they were taking off. Galen himself took off, excuse me, and tried to hide, and ultimately was found and brought back by the emperors to try to do something about the disease, but who could blame him for cutting and running when this thing was taking place. In the books, what we see is an incredible drop of revenue. Of course, the tax base, meaning taxed citizens, were dying at such a prolific rate that income wasn't coming in. We see at this time a cessation of building projects. Now, we're talking 166. Just before this thing hit, Rome is peaking. I mean, think of Rome when you think of all the big, beautiful buildings, and this was a time of prolific growth. It was a time of all the monuments and all the incredible architecture of the Roman culture was flourishing. Building projects and were profound during this period of time. And that came to a stop. Ironically, what we still see, though, in the ledgers, is while all building projects stopped, income went down, we see actually expenditures going up in a particular arena, and that was the building of temples. During this period, as often you will see in history or even here in our own lives, people get sick. They find religion, a lot of them. And the Romans really pumped up their building of temples during this period. More temple being built than anything else. And that continued through this period. But what happened from there is very interesting, and many believe it was a pivotal moment for the success of Christianity, because something took place. These people who were following in a very varied fashion of following the way of Jesus were doing something that nobody else was doing at that time. Number one, they were not showing fear, and they were not fleeing. In fact, during this period, Christianities began to flourish in many ways, shapes, and forms, because the Christians at this time actually began to take care and minister to the sick, while everybody else wanted to run away. They were willing to bury the dead, even non-Christians. I'm just saying this wasn't just about Christians. They were doing this in an indiscriminate fashion. They were beginning to tend to the ill, and a couple of things happened there. The survival rate for many of the sick went up. Why? Well, simply because they would hydrate them. Somebody would actually bring them water. Somebody would actually bring them food. People would actually clothe them. People would be physically present, so you weren't alienated. And if any of you have been sick, you understand just the power of presence. You know, I mean, I think of a kid, man, just knowing my mom was there, or my mom was around, even when I was really sick, made me feel better. You add to that the positive thought of prayer, that people were actually praying for people. And this astounded the Romans during this period that they were, that many were fleeing. And of course, there was the issue as well that they didn't fear death. Their message was one that there is an afterlife, and you don't need to fear it. That there is a paradise, and they did not fear dying for their faith, doing what they were called to do. It was during this period that the teachings of Jesus, and you got to remember, this is a period where there were no churches the way we think of church. Okay, there was not the Bible the way we think of the Bible. Most of these were Greco-Roman people, converts. They didn't know Judaism. They didn't have copies of the Torah lying around. They didn't have the Old Testament like we do today. They had maybe a letter or a parchment or a copy of a copy of a copy of a gospel, of various gospels that were going around. Most people were illiterate, couldn't read. I mean, only a few people had that luxury of getting an education and being able to read. So it's not like we think of today. It was a very different kind of Christianity. But the things that they had, they actually did. So when they heard the story of the Good Samaritan, when they heard these ethical teachings of love your neighbor as yourself, they actually began to do these things. They began to care for people. And this led to some amazing things. First of all, many of the Christians contracted the disease and died. Many contracted the disease and survived, even though horribly disfigured. But they became wounded healers because now they had immunity. And they began to tend even more for the plague during this 23-year period. And Christianity and these followers of the way became recognized as like, whoa, who are these people who show this incredible devotion to the needy? Of course, that's rooted in Judaism, in one sense. Judaism as a religion had some really mind-bending concepts that it introduced to the world. I mean, literally. Like when Judaism was talking about caring for the widow, caring for the poor, caring for the needy, when it was given instructions not to glean your whole crop, but to leave the exterior of the crop there so that poor people could come and eat them. These were mind-bending concepts, literally, in the world from an anthropological view. Because if you were poor, if you were widowed, if you were a child, if you were hungry, if you were infirm, the world at that time was dog-eat-dog and didn't give a rip about you. In fact, you are part of the problem. But Judaism definitely enters in. I mean, the whole concept of thou shalt not murder. You know, we kind of like, of course not. Back when that was introduced, they're like, why? Why not? They got a bunch of stuff. Have you seen their stuff? We should go over there, kill them all, and take their stuff. Could then be our stuff. That's the way the world was ruled. That's the way it went. So a concept of do not commit murder was just like, huh? Really? Yeah, no, it's not good. Okay. And out of this comes this evolution of Christianity where it's not only, you know, don't commit murder. It's not just what you're not supposed to do. Here's what you are to do and to do it indiscriminately. These things were taking place, the poor, the needy, the sick. And the temples were going up, but guess what? The Greek gods weren't answering prayers. Now, what's very interesting about Greco-Roman religion, you'll notice today, it doesn't exist anymore. You don't see these temples anymore. Nobody's lining up to worship Zeus or Apollo or anybody else. What? Why? Well, in part, we can trace it to this period and consequential periods after more plagues. The Greek gods weren't answering. Now, when you went to a Greek god to pray, though, it was a very selfish prayer. People lined up to temples because they wanted something. So when you went to temple, you went to the temple because you were going to make a demand, a request of the gods. Do this for me. I need this. Do this for us. They didn't walk out of there with a lot of instruction of like, no, 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 time out. You need to be doing this and this and this for others. That didn't exist in that religious system. And the temples went by the wayside. And yet here we sit 2,000 years later, along with a whole bunch of people all around the world on a Sunday morning, because we're connected to this history of our faith tradition, which when others were showing fear, we showed faith. When others were fleeing, we went to the need, the hurt, the pain. That's where many believe Christianity made a huge leap forward of making it in this hostile world. Okay, it didn't end there. It continued. As a matter of fact, Christians, as you know, were persecuted. They were seen as atheists, believe it or not, because they didn't believe in all the Roman gods. It wasn't the problem necessarily that they believed in a god. It was that they didn't believe in the Roman gods, and therefore they were considered atheists, and they were often targeted then at certain points as being the cause of the plague or the this or the that. That persecution continued all the way through to Diocletian in the early 4th century when he became the emperor, and ultimately he fell by the wayside. His vast persecution of the Christian community in the early 4th century, around 310 AD, came to a halt, and another emperor, Constantine, took over, and we know where it went from there. Constantine probably did more damage than any of the persecutions, because he converted, quote-unquote, to Christianity. Thank you very much. And I was looking for my water. I left it somewhere. I don't know where. Thank you. Why this is important to us and why we're sitting here today is that we have a faith tradition that was so different in a time and a season in the world where it should have been eradicated. It in fact began to flourish. It had a theology that was radically different from the theologies that were surrounding it. And this theology in its infancy was rooted in the sublime teachings of Jesus. It was a way of living, and thus called the way. Giant edifices and big temples weren't solving people's problems. There was no answer from those gods. But the Christian God had an answer. And the Christian God's answer was, you and me, real people, with real compassion and real love. And this was mind-bending into the world. It went to a whole new level of care and compassion. And this is why Christianity made it. Now, I say we don't look around and see lots of temples in our culture today to the Roman gods. But I could argue that we do see a lot of temples, and now they're Christian ones. And I can say that for a lot of people who go to these temples of what we call churches, they go for the same reasons that the Romans went 1,800 years ago. They go for a selfish reason because they want this God to do something for them. They want this God to fulfill their need. They want this God to give them power. And I would submit to you that that God isn't answering. And that's probably why you see so many people leaving the church in droves today. And if we're lucky, we're going to have a lot of empty churches in the future. Because that version of God is not the truth of our faith tradition. The truth of our faith tradition is we don't make demands of God for us. We come into union with God, and we become the answer of needs to others around us. It's kind of disheartening at times when you come to this realization. But guess what? The plagues are still out there. The people are still hurting. There are people with broken hearts, broken spirits, broken minds, broken bodies. And by and large, the world is still indifferent to the poor and to the suffering and to the needy. It is a time, I believe, that the followers of the way can really bring light, life, and love and reality of their faith tradition. Now, I believe we're doing that here. I really do. I believe we're evolving into that. I'm not saying we've arrived. I'm not saying we're finished. I really believe that. When I look at our community, and I'm going to speak without objectivity, because I'm not objective necessarily when it comes to you guys. When I see the people who are a part of our community doing what they do, and this is not stuff that's going up on billboards and headlights. I mean, it's just, it's the people who are calling other people. It's the people who are checking in on others. It's the people who are calling somebody up and say, hey, come join us for this. It's the people who are making meals and dropping meals off. And I don't want to embarrass my wife, but, you know, the other day we got home, we got to see an amazing tennis tournament, and I get home, and we got to stop at the grocery store first, and the next thing I know, we head home, and she's whipping up all this food because she's dropping food off to two people who are ill, and she's going to spend time with them, and this is a regular thing that happens all the time around here and with our people here, and it matters. It makes a difference. We live in a very cold world in many ways, and in this country can be as cold as any, and it is filled with edifices that are not bringing, are missing the opportunity, and that's why it's kind of cool in one sense when I think about, like, we're trying to lose a building, and other churches, you know, want to build bigger buildings. Now, I'm not against buildings. I've seen buildings do great things. That's not the point. But it gets, like I say, disheartening as I've traveled around the country when I go into some small town and hit an intersection and see four churches on four corners. You know, First Baptist here, Second Baptist there, First Presbyterian here, Second Presbyterian there. And you're looking at all these peoples who would all identify themselves, and I'm not judging that, as followers of the way, with four gigantic churches on four corners in a community full of hurting people. Wow, I think a lot of these folks back then would have been scratching their heads too. Like, whoa, this doesn't make sense to me. So I say this again because I'm excited about who we are, what we're doing, and where we're going as a church community. That path is clear to us, and we are going to be continuing to evolve. And it's good for us to know and to be proud and to think of our history. I mean, I don't do that enough, and you probably don't either, where we really sit down and we think about, like, wait a minute, what is our history? Our history is when others showed fear that we showed faith. Our history is when others fled, we fought. We stayed in the thick of things. Where others were hoarding, we were sharing. Where others were taking, we were giving. That's pretty fantastic. In a time and a place when we can't imagine it. We can't imagine what that plague looked like. If you've ever, you want to gross yourself out, go look up smallpox and hit images and see what I'm talking about. You got to imagine, these people are our parents. These people were people who looked at the most ferocious, unknown, unexplicable enemies like a plague and walked into it and started attending and caring and saving and helping people. They were the first real doctors and nurses and first responders, you know, long before there were firemen and EMTs. These people were walking into the teeth of battle and showing compassion and love and sacrifice. That is our history. That's what we're connected into when we get together. And who wants to forget that? I don't want to forget that. And who doesn't want to be fueled by that? I want to be fueled by that. We have a lot of hurting people. And we have a God who answers their prayers through us. And that is a beautiful thing. So, I hope that you just walk out of here today committed to the fact that we are not into building temples. We are the temple. And we're not into building edifices, and we are into building up people. And that we are all broken and wounded healers in this world. We all got brokenness. We all have our scars. But we also carry that knowledge and that faith into healing the mind, bodies, and spirits of others. I would also say this. A tragic side note is that at a certain period, Christianity evolved and began to use plagues as a threat from God. So you got that too. You've got this seminal teaching from Jesus and the early Christians who looked at God and saw God as a God of compassion and love, indiscriminate for all people, and then later it morphed into this God of shame and fear and condemnation. And when plagues hit, there are sermons as well in the 4th and 5th and 6th century when the bodies were burning, that became fodder for sermons. That's what's going to happen to you for all eternity. Isn't that weird? See how that took a major shift? Okay? That stuff needs to die. That's just got to be stomped and stamped out. And that kind of fear and loathing and shame. Listen, we're here today to be better versions of ourselves and make the world a better place. Period. Indiscriminately. That's what we're here to do. We're not here to judge or shame. That's why there's no membership at this church. There's no membership. We don't take offerings. You want to give, you give. That's okay. We're not here to guilt you. We don't even pass the damn basket around anymore, thank God. You didn't put anything in there. We don't do that. That's not what we're about. What we are about is trying to rediscover and live out the way of Jesus and to bring that to the table in our community, all right? So, be fueled, be proud, be excited. You belong to a great faith tradition. It has gone off the map at times, but I think we're plumbing. We're bringing something back to center. And when I say those churches are disappearing and shutting down, I say that actually with joy, but I also say other ones are opening up. There's a new flood of people who are really getting centered again upon Jesus and upon his teachings, and that's a beautiful thing. And peace and grace and strength and courage and wisdom and laughter and joy and love be with you.